So tonight, I'd like to talk about Tore Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow, which we read as the last piece in this evening, in the liturgy with which we started tonight. And I would like to talk about it particularly as guidance in how we can practice with our own hearts, our own minds, with the challenges that arise for us anywhere in our lives. This is one of my favorite pieces of liturgy, and one of the ones that I personally found so useful. And this piece was recently at the last Sesshin, the last multi-day retreat in which we sat together, was the theme of the retreat. Hearing kind of the ways that different people interacted with it and the kind of things that they experienced as barriers or challenges to hearing the teaching of this piece, I was actually inspired to re-render in my own kind of words and phrases the last two-thirds of this piece. And though that is a dubious form of art or academic translation, nonetheless, I think it might potentially be useful. So what I would like to do is read that to you guys. I'll read it twice, and then I'll talk about some of the stuff in this rendering. And this version I'm calling On Bowing Down. Even when we judge someone to be a fool, and even in the moments we feel hurt by another's angry words and deeds, even at those times, and even if that other is ourself, I've found we can suffer less if we return to the true root of compassion within our own hearts by recalling that we too, like that fool, get lost in our stories and also act foolishly. By recalling that we too, like that hurtful person, get caught in aversion and also cause harm. Recalling this, we can see that even now we are lost in stories. Even now we are caught in aversion and anger. And even now we are grasping on to how we think things should be. When we practice in this way, each judgment and each angry thought is as luminous and helpful to us as if the Buddha himself were appearing in our minds moment after moment after moment to show us the very ways we manufacture suffering for ourselves and the world again and again and again. Seeing this in any moment, we know deeply and for ourselves, it's best to bow down to the world as it in fact is and work intimately with our own hearts. And seeing this, what need is there to be ungrateful to anyone or anything? Now, gratefully receiving all the world, we vow to share this bounty with all beings so that we and the world together grow in wisdom. Even when we judge someone to be a fool, and even in the moments we feel hurt by another's angry words and deeds, even at those times, and even if that other is ourself, I've found we can suffer less if we return to the true root of compassion within our own hearts by recalling that we too, like that fool, get lost in our stories and also act foolishly. By recalling that we too, like that angry person, get caught in aversion and also cause harm. Recalling this, we can see that even now we are lost in stories. Even now we are caught in aversion and anger. And even now, we are grasping on to how we think things should be. When we practice in this way, each judgment and each angry thought is as luminous and helpful to us as if the Buddha himself were appearing in our minds, moment after moment after moment, to show us the very ways we manufacture suffering for ourselves and the world, again and again and again. Seeing this in any moment, we know deeply and for ourselves, it's best to bow down to the world as it in fact is, and work intimately with our own hearts. And seeing this, what need is there to be ungrateful to anyone or anything? Now, gratefully receiving all the world, we vow to share this bounty with all beings so that we and the world together grow in wisdom. One of the reasons that, so this is the latter two-thirds, the part about bowing down, and this is a phenomenally empowering practice. This is a practice that gives us a way to make use of and interact with any circumstance, no matter how unpleasant and how challenging. And what this doesn't involve is bowing down in subjugation and bowing down to become a doormat to let other people do what they will. And it isn't bowing down in inactivity. It is a practice that we can do inwardly, intimately, in a very small and personal and open-handed, receptive way in any circumstance. Now, also, this to take up this practice doesn't mean that we don't experience the arisings of judgment, like that person is a fool, or that we don't experience things as causing us pain. And in fact, when we experience any of those things, that itself can become a cue, a reminder, a big neon arrow saying, okay, this is the time to practice. Here's what you can do it with. So, so this Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow talks about even when someone else can be a fool, is a fool, or someone else is causing us pain. But so often, we are that someone else. And the ways that we talk to ourselves are so uncompassionate and aggressive that if we were to ever hear anyone outside us talking to someone that we care about in the same kind of voice that we use to talk to ourselves, we would certainly intervene with, hey, knock it off, all right? But somehow we think it's totally okay if we are completely aggressive against ourselves. And our Bodhisattva's vow, the vow of someone that who makes a commitment to working inwardly with his own, her own heart and mind in to bring a cessation to suffering for ourselves and the world. This is the Bodhisattva's vow. And this is not a vow to save, to serve, to be useful to all the beings except this one being over here who clearly isn't worth it or doesn't deserve it or is too far gone. So we need to include ourselves in the sphere of our own compassionate aspiration. And we even need to include the parts of ourselves that we most hate, that most cause us pain, and that are most falling short in our aspirations of how we wish we were. We need to include those parts of ourselves, and we need to include the part of ourselves that is standing on the outside saying to another part of ourselves, that's really bad, see, that's what I'm talking about, you're exactly that bad. We need to see each of those many selves within ourselves as another being, and extend our compassionate Bodhisattva vow to all of those selves within and all of these other beings who are also ourselves without. In the traditional version that we recite, Tori Zenji says it's best to bow down. And with that it's best, I think it's important to hear where that's coming from. And so this is why we say that, this is why I find it useful to hear it, and this is also how I hear the precepts, the guidelines for moral and ethical action in Buddhism, as prefaced with, I found we can suffer less. So this is speaking from experience. There are no shoulds in Zen. There's only advice. There's only things that you can try out and test for yourselves and see whether they are useful to you in alleviating suffering. And until you are able to see that for yourself, what you can take advantage of is other people who have walked this path before you, other people who have suffered and been in pain in exactly the ways that you are now. Because all of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ancient teachers and modern teachers all felt, and in fact in many ways feel to themselves, exactly as we feel to ourselves. There's not a special class of being that is a Buddha, a special class of being that is someone who can keep bodhisattva vows, a special class of being that can follow the precepts or become a Zen teacher. Those people are only ever people like us. And that's why their teachings are useful to us, because they're just like us and because we are just like them. And so from that perspective, it's valuable to know what it is that they've found as they've carefully investigated their own, the source of suffering arising with them. And that's ultimately what this endeavor of Zen and Buddhism is it's a science of investigating what is it that gives rise to suffering, and how is it that when suffering has arisen, we can find a freedom that is undisturbed by that suffering, or a freedom to suffer, or a freedom amid suffering. And this is what this path teaches. And this is what people who teach this path hopefully have found and verified for themselves. If they can't tell you that they have verified a certain amount for themselves, it's not clear what exactly you're doing listening to their advice on the topic. But these things that are these liturgical texts, these practices, these tools of investigation like Zazen and Shikantaza and koans, and these teachings such as the precepts, are all things that generations of people just like us have found useful to this very endeavor. So I found we can suffer less if we return to the true root of compassion within our own hearts by recalling that we too, like that fool, get lost in our stories and also act foolishly. By recalling that we too, like that hurtful person, get caught in our aversion and also cause harm. So that Zen and in Buddhism, and in fact in Shin, which is another variety of Buddhism that has influenced me a lot, compassion isn't some special kind of feeling that we have. It isn't some way that a good person feels as opposed to whatever it is that we feel. Compassion actually is recognizing that other people are just like us. And there's another, and self-compassion is a recognition that we are just like other people. And that in it, all of this also comes from an important understanding that the people do what they do for reasons. And we don't actually need to assess the goodness or badness of those reasons. And the Buddhist term for that is causes and conditions that give rise to things being as they are. And Buddhism, the three roots of all suffering and the three roots of all harming action are called greed, anger, and ignorance, grasping, aversion, and the stories that we tell ourselves, or certainty in our righteousness. Those are the three roots of all suffering. And any time anyone is causing harm in the world, whether it's small or vast, it's coming from a place of grasping, aversion, or believing stories. And we can, by returning to the true root of compassion in ourselves, we by remembering that we are basically foolish beings, by seeing how much harm we cause even with our best intentions, by seeing how hard it is for us to even have those best intentions most of the time. Sometimes we can't even muster the will to wish we could cause less harm. And by recognizing this in ourselves, by really letting the whole of ourselves in, that is a practice of self-compassion. That is a practice of at-one-ment and being at one with the atonement, at one with the reality of who this foolish being in fact is and how difficult it is to be a human being. And when we see this with regard to ourselves, we can then remember that that person too, that person who is acting so foolishly, that person who clearly wishes nothing but ill for this other person, is doing so, or for us, is doing so for something similar to the same kind of grasping, aversion, and stories and certainty that we so often fall under the sway of. And recognizing this is really the root of compassion. It doesn't mean, and we know that, we know how hard it is to be a human being in this world. We know how complicated and unfathomable and or semi-fathomable our reasons for doing the things that we do are. We can recognize our own karma, our own series of causes and conditions that go back to beginningless time that bring us to right here. And we can see how hard it is for us to be us and remember that there is a suffering being. And we know how much it hurts when we get caught up by that that grasping or the aversion or in our stories. And we can see, even when somebody else is causing harm or being a fool, we can see that ultimately is a source of suffering for them and the world. And we can therefore compassionately identify with them. And this doesn't mean we manufacture some kind of benevolent aura that we then spray on people with the awesomeness of our goodness. Right? That's not compassion. Compassion is recognizing I'm a foolish being, and that other person, probably a foolish being too. Recalling this, we can see that even now we are lost in our stories. Even now we are caught in aversion and anger. And even now we are grasping on to how we think things should be. So this is really crucial. And this is kind of the instrumental functioning of how this practice works. So whenever we're thinking, man, you are being so obnoxious, or whenever we're thinking, boy, that guy is an idiot, or whenever we're thinking, my God, you singing people, can't you see I'm trying to meditate here? In those very moments, right, in the act of judging, in the act of getting angry and pushing away and screaming, that is us enacting foolish being. That indicates right now that we have an idea of the way the world is, and then we see that the world is not that way. We grab onto the way the world is. We push away the way, we grab onto the way it isn't, the way we wish it were. We push away the way it is. And we give more energy into our grasping and our aversion. And or we go on endlessly talking to ourselves about how right we are and how good we are and how much other people are wronging us, you know, and that is getting lost in our stories. And the very act of thinking someone is a fool, the very act of feeling hurt and angry, when those things arise in your mind, as they will, no matter how compassionate you become, no matter how much zazen you do, because that's part of what it means to be human. So, but those things will arise in your mind. But then what we can cultivate is a response of noticing, oh, here's that anger thing. As opposed to the alternative, which we come to very honestly and for a lot of good, understandable social and environmental and developmental and biological reasons, the alternative is to just respond. So anger comes up, we act angrily. We get kind of yanked around by going after what we want, pushing away what we don't want, continually going and being provoked to confrontation and continually trying to fix the world to match our ever-changing and ungraspable idea of the way things ought to be. So this is that's the autopilot. That's the kind of samsaric circle of suffering. That's the way that suffering just gives rise to more suffering and more causes of suffering, which then gives rise to more suffering and more causes of suffering. And what this practice of zazen lets us do is interrupt that cycle by bringing awareness to it, right in the middle of it. And that doesn't mean that then all suffering ceases, but it means that each cycle, rather than going around and around and around and around forever, goes around and around however many times it goes around, and then you notice, oh, this is that thing. And then you have a choice. And you, and then you can again return to your remembering. Oh, right, this is me being a foolish being. Oh, right, and that guy's probably a foolish being too. And it is our experience of that guy's a fool, and I don't mean to be pointing my teeth repeatedly. And our experience of, oh my God, you are so hurtful. It is precisely that experience which can become the reminder of how we break the cycle. And it's always going to be the thing that's perpetuating the cycle is always, always, always going to be greed, anger, and ignorance, grasping, aversion, or certainty in stories. And so to when we're feeling anything like that, to look and see if we can find whether there's some grasping or aversion going on. And look whether to see we're telling ourselves a story in our own mind. When we practice in this way, each judgment and each angry thought is as luminous and helpful to us as if the Buddha himself were appearing in our minds moment after moment after moment to show us the very ways we manufacture suffering for ourselves and the world. So this is the way that on each flash of thought, a lotus flower blooms. On each flash of thought, a Buddha. And that doesn't mean that we have thoughts of lotus flowers, thoughts of Buddhas, thoughts of light and all of this. It is the thoughts are exactly our judgmental thoughts. They are exactly our angry and self-centered thoughts. And they are exactly the stories we tell ourselves. There's not another set of thoughts we should be having instead. But when those thoughts arise, by recognizing them as thoughts, by recognizing them as mental formations arising out of grasping, aversion, uncertainty, and stories, then those thoughts, just as they are, become teaching tools to us. They become the Buddha holding us and helping us find freedom amid all this suffering. And seeing this in any moment, we know deeply and for ourselves, it's best to bow down to the world as it in fact is. So seeing this in any moment, right? It does. So maybe we go around and around in the circle of suffering 8,000 times, and then in the 8,001st revolution, we see, oh, right, this is that cycle of suffering. And then as soon as we see that, we know because we have seen that this is how we make things worse for ourselves. This is how we end up acting unkindly in the world. This is how we end up diverting ourselves from being the person we mean to be. And that right now, by telling ourselves these stories, we are continuing to make suffering for ourselves. And the traditional image for this is grasping on to hot coals that we're going to throw at some bad guy. But we're reaching in, we're grabbing on to the hot coals, and we're talking about how much, you know, we're going to just totally throw these hot coals. Ow! Right? To notice that burning. And to notice, yeah, I'm going to set those down. That's what it means. We recognize it's best. So Tori Zenji is saying, so you may find that if there are hot coals in your hand and they're burning and they're really starting to hurt, you might find it's best to put those down. Maybe that'll, you know, help a little bit. It isn't anything any more kind of epic or transcendent than ceasing to do that, even for a moment. It's like the old joke about the foolish person who's hitting himself on the head repeatedly with a hammer. Why are you doing that? Because it feels so good when I stop. We don't quite need to be that foolish person, but we can still notice that if for a moment we stop beating ourselves on the head with a hammer, that actually feels a little better. And that is verifying the Dharma for ourselves. It's nothing other than that. It's just that. So, it's best to bow down to the world as it in fact is. We're not bowing down to that foolish person, like Keith. We're not bowing down to, you go ahead and do whatever you want, it's fine, I'm just gonna sit here in meditation. We're not bowing down to passivity, to inaction, to opting out of our lives. We are bowing down to the world as it in fact is. We're opting wholly in to our lives, to borrow Jeff's phrase. In bowing down to the world as it is, in acknowledging, yes, this is the world as it is, that becomes a starting place. If we're doing anything other than bowing down to the world as it is, we're engaged in a story of grasping and aversion. We're engaged we're trying to engage with the world as we think it ought to be, which it isn't. So, and it's this acknowledgement and this bowing down to the world as it in fact is just an acknowledgement that this is the place we have to start. Right now, with things as they are, with our mind as it is, with our foolishness as it is, with Keith's foolishness as it is, we have to start here, now. And there's no other place to start, right? So there's really no other option. But recognizing that and reminding ourselves of there's no other option is the empowerment. That is the thing that gives rise to freedom, to choicefulness, to an ability to do our foolish best at being the person we need to be. It starts, and that is that bowing down to the world as it in fact is atonement, is at one-ment, in exactly the sense that that word is used in the Gatha of Atonement. It's best to bow down. You know, it's best. You don't have to. You totally don't have to. You might find that it hurts a little less if you bow down to the world as it in fact is and work intimately with our own hearts. Now, this the place that the freedom arises is not outward. It's not big and dramatic. It's not showy. It's not all that impressive. And if you talk about it or you to other people or you look at what you're doing, it's really not a big deal. It's really a very small inward gesture. It's just about a slight readjustment in how you relate to your own internal experiences. And it doesn't mean that you don't have one set of internal experiences, like pain and frustration and anger and impatience and whatever else. And it doesn't mean that you always have another set of experiences, like feeling however you imagine an enlightened person feels, or feeling blissed out or relaxed or completely unruffled by the difficulties of the world. It isn't about that at all. But it's about working with your ruffledness in a very small, different way, in a very intimate, personal, maybe totally invisible to everyone else kind of way. But even that little teeny turn in your own heart can give you a taste in this moment of some freedom, of some choicefulness, of some compassion for yourself and the world. And seeing this, what need is there to be ungrateful for anyone or anything, including for all of our ingratitude that arises? Even that, we can see that that is also unnecessary, and we can greatly gratefully receive the neon arrow that is our ingratitude as a reminder of, oh, this is me thinking the world should be different. And then the more often we encounter our self-created suffering, the more often we have our attention called to the ways that we're pushing away our experience, pushing away ourselves, separating ourselves from other people, the more opportunities we have to practice this intimate inward gesture. And this is exactly what we are practicing in Zazen. This is why Zazen is not about not having other thoughts. It's not about keeping your mind still. It's not about feeling any one way. And in fact, the more often your mind moves, the more often you have the opportunity to say, oh, my mind's moved, and bring it back. And so And it's that seeing and returning that is exactly the same thing that Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow is talking about. And it's exactly that thing that we practice elsewhere in our lives. And so we see that there's no need to be ungrateful, and we can start to be grateful even for our difficulties, grateful even for our inability to be grateful for our difficulties. Doesn't matter where you start with that, you can be grateful for this difficult moment just as it is, this foolish being just as it is, that foolish being just as it is. And now, gratefully receiving all the world, and that this is another aspect of this at-one-ment and this working intimately, is it's a receptive state. It's receiving the world, receiving this moment, receiving this difficulty, which is which I always illustrate with this open-handed gesture, which for me communicates some state of mind, and this is the traditional Zen story about a scholar goes to see a Zen master and says, "So tell me about the Dharma," and the Zen master pours him tea and keeps pouring him tea, and it fills up and he's keeping pouring it, and the scholar's like, "Hey, you know, the cup's full, you can't actually put anything else in there," and he says, "Well, your mind, like this cup, is full," and so there's a state when we become unable to receive, and so then we receive that state. We empty our cup by acknowledging, "Oh, this is where I am," and let the rest of the world in. So, gratefully receiving all the world, we vow to share this bounty of all the world, this bounty of each difficulty being an opportunity to find freedom, being an entranceway to the very freedom that we most need. Every thought, every difficulty, every pain. And then we vow to share this bounty with all beings so that we and the world together grow in wisdom. We and the, and this is the only way it can happen, we and the world together. It's all one thing. We can't keep it for ourselves. We can't keep it from that person. We can't just trust that the world is going to do it and we don't have to, or we can't. But we and the world together grow in wisdom. And this is also an important teaching. The Buddha says in the Dhammapada that violence is never stopped by violence. Hatred is never stopped by hatred. That the cycle of violence is only stopped with love, only stopped with compassion. And so, and this is incumbent upon us to, even when we see what we are sure are evils in the world, to make sure we are not replicating that evil, because that evil in the world is coming from aversion. And we need to make sure that for ourselves, we are not replicating that aversion by pushing away and acting angrily against that thing that we think is so evil. Because the chances are that person is also acting out of that exact same aversion. So the only place the cycle can break is in us. And that is how we and the world together grow in wisdom. And how fortunate that the only place that this can take place is in us. That's good news, because if it had to start out there, you would be dependent, and the world would be dependent on some circumstance being some way and not some other way. But it actually isn't. It's dependent on you working intimately with your own heart. This is this is an opportunity that is always available to you. And so, I urge you to take with you aspiration to notice when you get caught in grasping aversion or stories, and to let that very noticing remind you of how you can work intimately by receiving that arising without acting it out. And amid all this, being the person you mean to be and doing what is possible and necessary for you to do in the realms of the world and and families and relationships and societies and in all of this, to take that intimate work outward and do what needs doing in the world, but do it recognizing you're a foolish being. Do it without getting caught in replicating the same grasping and aversion that has given rise to so much suffering. So, I'm going to leave it there for now and open up the space for questions, comments, observations, complaints.
Yes, I was just thinking, you know, the thing about choosing not to act out your anger, and I was wondering, you know, how can you assert yourself without acting out, you know, things like anger and, you know, having that power?
So, and this is not about don't assert yourself. But this is there's a way in which, you know, the reason that anger has evolved in us as a species is because in some ways it does make it easier to respond to things, to do what needs doing. And part of what is the task of the Bodhisattva path is to still do what needs doing, but to do it without relying on the crutch of I'm right and you're wrong, of I'm good and you're bad, and ultimately when we are recognizing kind of our own anger, then if we work with that, then we actually have more options available to us of how we engage with somebody else, of how we engage with a situation. We can start to find we can start to see if there are other more skillful options to engaging with it. And it's often the case that when we meet somebody with anger, that we provoke then a defensive response, and then we're butting heads like this. Whereas if we see anger arise in ourselves, or if we see anger there and then see anger arise in ourselves, and instead of acting that out, we can work intimately with our own hearts and say, I'm having a response to that, and I'm seeing that what I need, that what I want to say is this, and I'm feeling like in order to take care of myself, I need to do this. And so there's ways of interacting with it. And so the question of how to be assertive is a vast, wide topic, and there are a lot of skills to be found there. They're not exactly Dharma skills as such. They're very useful and worth learning. The thing that the Dharma adds is to use those assertiveness skills without the crutch of anger behind them. And then when we do that, what we find is that actually then our assertiveness becomes more effective So that's a partial response to your question, which is an excellent question. And one that I want to encourage you to continue to work with in yourself, because the real answer comes from you. How can I be assertive in this situation? How can I do what needs to be done right now? And how is it best for me to do it? Is it best for me to do what needs doing angrily, or is it best for me to do what needs doing recognizing the impulse towards anger and doing what needs doing without aligning with that impulse? So to continue, so that question of how can I be skillfully and compassionately assertive in this situation is a excellent way for you to frame for yourself the essential how to find Dharma practice in this moment. So for you to find what it means to really practice Dharma in this moment is going to be, how can I be skillfully and compassionately assertive here? And that answer is going to come from you and be a process. Thank you. So there's actually a story that I can't recall the precise details of, but it's in the Pali Canon, the teachings of the actual Buddha, in which he basically gives the example, and here's where I'm going to get it wrong, of somebody shows up at your door with a gift of a big old basket of dog dew. What can you do then? And the Buddha basically says that you can say, no thank you. Yeah, no thank you. No, no, here it is, take it. No thank you. And that really is an option. And as much as we can, tell ourselves a story or manufacture an image of, so what if they take the coals and they put it in our hand and then they put duct tape, put the coal around our hand, you know, right? Like, we can make it as involved as we want, but there actually is always going to be some level where we can find that we can say no thank you, and in saying no thank you, we then be the person we mean to be, rather than the person who got sucked into having these goals taped into his hand. And this no thank you isn't slamming the door in the face. It isn't throwing the coals back at him, but it isn't actually opting out. It's actually engaging with the situation as it is. And the way that you can engage with that situation as it is in that way is to recognize that that's what's happening, and then to not go there to some degree. Example is also that's what we do. We're the guy who keeps on scooping up the coals and putting them in our hands, right? So that's always what it is. There's always somebody who's doing that, and it's either us or them, and it doesn't actually matter, because the thing to do is this thing over and over again, and doing this thing over and over again, practicing this skill, recognizing this over and over again, starts to cool the coals, starts to make the coals less compelling to pick up. Then the situations start to loosen and have more options. But we may have to. We're going to have to do this again and again and again. And this guy, whether it's him, us, or him, who's putting the coals in our hands, how wonderful, giving us the opportunity to practice with the very mind state that creates suffering for us. So even if nothing changes, and again and again and again, we or they put these coals in our hand, that's the opportunity, just like Zazen, to practice noticing how suffering arises and desisting from it, even for a microsecond. Good question. Right.
It's sort of a holier than nothing. And it's just bizarre how vindictive it is. So how would
right.
you respond to that?
Right. Well, I mean, so that's a great observation. And you've put your finger on a part of it, of how addictive it is, of how you like the feeling of feeling holier, you know, and how your how it's the energy of grasping, and that energy of grasping, what you're grasping after is actually suffering. Great, I've got more of it. You know, and so as you start to see that, then you can think, I don't know, maybe that's not what I want to do. So to start to have that choice. Maybe it is what you want to do. I don't know. And it's fine if it is. But that isn't what the Dharma teaches, because that's grasping after suffering, holding on to more of it, and seeing how much you can put in your little bundle. But there's an alternative. And to verify this alternative for yourself, and then to see the impulse towards doing it the other way, and to see that impulse arising. It's important to recognize, as I think you do, that Buddhism is not advocating stoicism. Buddhism is not advocating sucking it up or white-knuckling it or, you know, letting everybody run all over you. That is not at all what's going on here. It's about working intimately with your own heart with regard to that foolish being's own heart, who wants to grasp after suffering. Right, that's the foolish being to receive intimately. But even recognizing that that's what you do is a powerful step. And to recognize that that's what you're doing right now is to receive that Buddha appearing to you with the big neon sign saying, here it is, buddy. That's how he sounds. That's how the Buddha sounds, in case you were wondering. He said it in Pali, though. Yeah. That's a really good question. That is a really good question. One part of the answer is that nothing about Buddhism says care less. However, so do care, because that care is your own compassionate heart responding to suffering and responding compassionately to the suffering of the world and seeing suffering in this other person. Nothing about Zen, about these practices, about Buddhism, is about quashing that, shutting that down. However, it is not the case that what you should do is say, hey, buddy, you over there, you're creating suffering, and you know what? You need to knock that off, and in fact, I can tell you how to do it. Right? And to notice that urge, and this is an image I use a lot. So there's that when you're pointing this finger, saying you, right there, you're creating suffering. There's these three fingers pointing back at you, creating suffering right now. And that's what it means. That's what the part about even now we're engaged in grasping. Even now we're engaged in aversion. So the thing that you can do to diminish suffering in the world is notice when you have fallen into saying, you over there, you're doing it wrong, and to work intimately with your own heart. And in that way, you and the world together grow in wisdom. And this is why Buddhism is not a proselytizing religion. And but this isn't to say that it's a powerless or do-nothing religion, because actually working intimately with our own hearts can be profoundly transformative of seemingly intractable situations. And and working intimately with our own heart is something that can be perceived and can open up avenues for change. So care that person is acting foolishly, but work on this person who's acting foolishly. Great stuff, everyone. Thank you so much.